Well, hello, this is Portney Guest Kim. I'm introducing Mr. John O'Neill, author of The Fisherman's Tomb, The True Story of the Vatican's Secret Search. And it's a secret search for St. Peter's grave, which Pope Francis confirmed did find the bones of St. Peter. In fact, more than St. Francis, I mean Pope Francis, he in 2013 reaffirmed that they are the bones of St. Peter. Before that, in 1966, Pope Paul VI also recognized these bones. So, Mr. O'Neill, tell us why in 2018 should we be reading this book? Why do we need to know?
Well, the reason I wrote the book is we live in an incredibly secular world, and people just don't touch reality often. They don't even believe in ancient history, much less these are foreign. They think they're fictional figures, Courtney, like a movie, and they aren't. They were real people. They really did live. The bones and tomb of St. Peter, which have been located, are the oldest fully authenticated Christian relics in the entire world. The process of finding them was amazing, and of course, they themselves are amazing. The inscriptions found close to the tomb of Peter are foundational. That is, to anybody who's a Christian, they're incredibly important. They show that Christians at the very earliest time, roughly 66 to 250 AD, believed exactly the same things we believe now. A lot of people claimed in the 1960s and 70s, my faith was tested by the claim that Christianity was just a cult, that it was just an evolving cult, and it wasn't. From inception, people believed that Christ was divine and that through his death on the cross, he had made resurrection possible for all of us, and they had to write it in code and so on. But they actually etched that in stone 400 yards from the emperor's palace under fear of being killed from the very beginning of the Christian religion.
Right, so one of the things about this book that you wrote is a little different from a couple of earlier books that do talk about the discovery of the grave of St. Peter back in the 1939. So there was another book I read, I think it was originally published in 1982, where the factual information is, you know, the details, it goes into more maybe technical details about the measurements and so forth. But in this book, you really give a lot of context, which I get the impression has not been done before in terms of the historical tying in both what was going on in 1939 in Italy as going all the way back to the beginnings of the church.
The first real book on this subject was by John Evangeline Walsh.
That's what I'm talking
1982.
About.
1982. Mm-hmm. It was a wonderful book.
Right.
Margherita Carducci cooperated and was the force behind the writing of that book. Mm-hmm. And my book just stands on the shoulders of John Walsh's, Evangeline Walsh's book. The reason why I thought it was important to write my book is first, there's an awful lot of new information since 1982 mm-hmm. about what actually transpired, including a lot of physical evidence. Second, he didn't have the backstory, which is very interesting, of the aid of the given to the Pope by the Strakes here in Houston, by people like Monsignor Walter Carroll, and the like. And so I thought that adding those two in, plus the opening of the Scavi tour and a lot of other stuff made it worthwhile to write another book. But the Walsh book is a wonderful book, and I recommend it to anybody to read. It's as you say, more technical than mine. It stands, in turn, on the shoulders of two books by Margherita Carducci in 1960 and 1966. Those are great books, but they're so technical, they're very hard to read. So what I was trying to do is produce a book that would be easy to read, that the average person could read, because in truth, what was found here is really, it's really, really important to all Christians, to Catholics, to all other Christians, and really to everybody. So I tried to make it a simple, easy-to-read book for that reason.
Well, and one of the things that struck me about this book is that you make it clear that the actual grave where Peter was buried originally was venerated by Christians and became a place that they went to from the very beginning. So could you tell us, just start at the beginning, and what is, who's St. Peter and what happened to him?
of course, Peter was sort of Christ's man, I guess you'd say. He was clearly the leader of the church on earth. Peter was conveyed the keys to the church by Christ, who said that whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. And so he was clearly the leader. Now, he was a quixotic human being. He'd do half the stuff wrong and half the stuff right. He was very human. He's the same guy who would deny Christ right when the three roosters crowed, and at the same time would defend Christ all by himself against an armed mob who, right after Christ was crucified, went into the Sanhedrin and berated them all, the highest legal authority, for doing what they did. He would have almost died from that. He was a fisherman, and if we assume he was about 30 years old or so when he met Christ, around 66 AD, he would have been 65 years old. He was, of course, what we know from the Bible is that he was the early leader of the entire church. He started in Jerusalem, he traveled, and the Bible leaves him in 44 AD in Antioch. And as to what happened after that, there's only this clue. There are two letters of Peter's, for Peter 1 and Peter 2, 1st and 2nd Peter, if you want to call them that. They don't actually tell us where they're from. They make allusions to Babylon, but they're a man on the run. He knows he's going to be killed, at least reading that's how I read them, and I think how most biblical scholars read them. Because the Bible doesn't tell us exactly where he went, a lot of people denied that Peter ever went to Rome at all. Luther, for example, claims that St. Peter's was built on a pagan foundation and claims that Peter never went to Rome at all. So there was ambiguity. Now, the great tradition of the church was that we know that Nero in 66 AD, he was a terrible human being, started a fire in Rome just to clear out the center of Rome to build a huge palace. He was going to build a statue 110 feet high of himself, standing on the world. He started the fire in the summer of 66 AD. It burned out the entire center of Rome, all the great temples, that had, one of them, the temple of Jupiter, had gone on for 700 years. Was the heart of the Roman city. He burned out all the great houses on the Palatine Hill, and so the Romans were really willing to get him, and he started the rumor that the Christians had done this. He behaved terribly with the Christians. He got them. He turned them into human torches to light his garden. He took the little kids and tied them, sewed them into wild animal hides, and had dogs tear them apart. Even the Roman historians, who were not a meek people, were appalled by how terribly he treated the Christians. He killed Paul, and Paul relates in 2 Timothy, recites that his impending death, "I fought the good fight, I've run the race to the finish." He also got Peter. Tradition says that they captured him, that he was taken to the emperor's gardens about 400 yards from the present Vatican Hill to be killed, and he asked only that he be crucified upside down because he wasn't worthy to be crucified in the same way as Christ. There are contemporaneous accounts that show us that the Roman soldiers really did crucify people in different positions, and then they would bet on how long they'd live. It was sort of a joke betting game to them as these people died terribly. Tradition said after his death, the The Romans threw his body on a trash heap at Vatican Hill, and the followers of Christ came. They got Peter, and they wrapped him in a purple and gold cloth, and they buried him right there. And that later, a marker, sometimes called Gaius's trophy, was erected over Peter's grave. There are accounts in 96 AD, Ignatius, a bishop who was taken to Rome to be killed, and he said, and I'm paraphrasing, I'm really happy to be going to Rome so I can die like Peter and Paul did. In 150 AD approximately, Gaius said, look, if you don't believe in all of this, come with me and I'll take you to Vatican Hill and I'll show you a trophy built over the grave of Peter by Christians. Finally, in 444 AD, the Book of Popes says Peter was buried directly under St. Peter's. But that wonderful St. Peter's that we all saw, nobody had any real idea what was under it. In 330 AD, circa 300, actually 315 to 330 AD, the original St. Peter's was constructed out of wood at the request of Helena. Tradition said it was spot on over Peter's grave. And then Rome fell. The great barbarian invasions occurred. All knowledge of what was under St. Peter's and so on died. Most written works in the world died. Knowledge really died. And that's pretty much where things stood for almost 1,000 years. In 1500, St. Peter's was collapsing, and so Pope Julius and other popes determined that the original wooden St. Peter's had to be replaced. It was a tragedy the way they did it, candidly, because the great artwork of Giotto, the tombs of over 100 popes, were all simply destroyed and discarded, and the new St. Peter's was built. The one thing that they didn't do is in any way disturb the foundations of St. Peter's, except that they dropped two shafts down to see if they could find Peter. What the shafts found were exactly what they didn't want to find at all, because they ran across a statue of a half-naked guy holding a goblet of wine in the air, and it was inscribed, "Bring me the young girls, for tomorrow you will die too." This was not what the priests were looking for, particularly after Luther had claimed that it was all built on a pagan foundation. So they got the statue, and they threw it in the Tiber, and they sealed the shafts. But word of what they did sort of leaked out to some degree. And from that time, for 400 years, no one went under St. Peter's at all. Nobody wanted to go under St. Peter's after that experience. I mean, that seemed to invalidate everything. That's why it was so incredibly brave that Pius XII was willing to launch this. The way it got launched is in the most fortuitous of circumstances. There's much about the whole search when you think about it. It's amazing it could happen like that. But Pius XI wanted to be buried under St. Peter's. There were other people buried under there, but not in a long time. And so they determined they would erect an altar for him. And they began digging the altar, and a workman fell 25 feet down. He was in a magnificent room, maybe twice the size of this room, with fabulous Roman artwork, mosaics, statuary all around, that no one had any idea were there. They looked a little further, and they found the tomb of a Christian woman named Emilia Gorgonis, who was 28 years old. Her tomb was decorated with the familiar fish symbol of the Christians, and most especially the Samaritan woman pouring the jar of grace, the Samaritan woman being the very first person to announce that Christ was the Messiah in the Bible. And this is 400 yards from the tomb of, I mean, from the Nero's, you know, palace. There is nothing. I've looked in the whole world at Christian ruins, and there is virtually nothing from the first or second century. That's because they were on the run, they were being killed everywhere. You can find a few little things that may be Christian in Ephesus. There are the tops of a cave down in southeast Turkey that have actual Christian drawings and catacombs. There are a few references in the catacombs, but there's nothing. And so to find a Christian tomb 400 yards from the emperor's deal, it's like in your face. Mm-hmm. It's like the El Qaeda operating something next to the Pentagon. It's inconceivable, because Christianity was an underground religion. Well, based on that, Pius decided he wanted to take a gamble and see if he could find it. His first step was to go into the Vatican Library, where found those three pieces that I mentioned of documentation. The Vatican Library is, if you ever get a chance to see it, one of the most magnificent libraries in the world. It has 1,100,000 volumes, but it has 75,000 codices, original codices from prior to the time of the collapse of the empire, and that exists nowhere else in the world, now on microfilm, but nowhere else other than that. And it is a tremendous reservoir of information. Of course, to make it all go through, he organized some extraordinary people. Ludwig Kos, the last leader of opponents of the Nazis in Germany, who was moved to the Vatican so that he wouldn't be killed. Father Walter Carroll, a fabulous American man with incredible joy of life, who knew he would die in a short time because of his heart. The fellow who had become Pope, Pope Paul VI, then called Montini, and a guy named McGow, who was an amazing con man, who set up a scheme called the Refugee Bureau that saved the lives of hundreds of thousands of Jews in World War II. And this was their task. Well, the church is broke. This is 1939. 1940, the Great Depression has descended, Mexico's gone, Spain is in ruins, the German Nazis are occupying most of the continent of Europe, Poland's gone, all of Eastern Europe has gone to the communists, Italy is occupied by the fascists, the Great Depression has descended on the whole world, so the church didn't have money to throw into a project of infinite cost, and so what they literally did was show up right over here, a few blocks away. I just met the guy who is living there, actually, this morning. And they showed up at this house on Inwood, an English Tudor house, and they saw George Strait there.
They were in Houston, Texas.
And they offered him a proposition that would be unappealing to anybody I ever knew of a right mind. Strake had given immense amounts of money to the Catholic Church, but the proposition, they said, Mr. Strake, I'm an emissary from Pope Pius XII, and he would like to know, he wants to thank you for everything you've done, but he would like to know if you would be willing to finance the most secret and most important project of the Catholic Church. If you do this, no one will ever know that you participate in this. The project may completely fail, and the cost is infinite, like a blank check. And Strait inexplicably said yes. Said, what's the project? And they said, well, we're going to try and find Peter under St. Peter's. And so Strait became the financing source for all of that, and probably provided technical assistance as well at a critical time in 1951. And so that's how the project kicked off. The Nazis controlled Europe. And in the middle of the project, 1943, the Italian government collapsed, and the Nazis actually occupied Rome itself, began executing Jews right in Rome, and occupied the whole areas around the Vatican. The Pope insisted that all the work be done with hand tools, so that it would be completely secret and completely quiet. The temperatures inside, in the underground, when they were doing this, were horrible. They were 110 to 120 in the summers. They had a constant threat of cave-ins. There was dust everywhere. It was terrible. And he did it with priests and with Vatican workers, who were all sworn to secrecy. And as for 9 years, absolutely no one had any idea this project was underway. They started at one end, and where the workmen had fallen in with the big room, and they quickly realized that that big room was just one of a whole series of Roman tombs.
Let's just stop and say how it is that nobody knew. Just, you said the barbarians invaded Rome, and for 1,000 years
Right.
There were no records, but basically what had been completely forgotten was that there really were a whole, almost a little town, a little, not a little, a cemetery, a Roman cemetery on Vatican Hill.
Right. Right. What the Romans had done after Peter's body was thrown, it was a trash heap then. Well, what happened is the Romans had Roman family tombs. So if you took like John O'Neill, I would be in a tomb with five generations one way, five generations another way, and the tomb would be like a second house. If you think about a vacation house, that was sort of what the tomb was like. And everybody would go there five, six times a year to celebrate Junivus and other Roman festivals. And when people walked out of town on the Appian Way, they'd go over, hey, there's the Joneses house and there's the such and such house. And it commemorated the dignitas of the whole family. The Romans believed that really lived for the dignity and honor of individual families. Well, when the Appian Way filled up, people began building around 100 AD, or maybe even earlier, 75 AD. They began building these family tombs on the Vatican Hill, which was actually a hill in those days. And you could see the hill as you left Rome, and they built some fabulous family tombs on that hill, okay? Roll forward a little bit, and Constantine becomes the emperor after terrible persecutions, and he promises his mother that he'll build a church right over Peter's grave. He's got a problem. If he knocks down those family tombs, he's going to have a war in his hands. All those families are going to go to war with him. And yet at the same time, he's got to have a flat place to build a great church. The solution was to fill it, to bring in millions of tons of fill and flatten it to the top and then build the church on top of that, centering the whole thing over Peter's grave. The effect of that was to create a hidden world underneath that church that nobody realized existed in later years. So they fill it, there are all those tombs underneath there, and then who sweeps in but the Vandals, the Gauls, wave after wave of barbarians. All those families are all killed off. There are no old ancient Roman families. All written knowledge and the ability to read largely dies everywhere. And knowledge of what was under there completely died. No one had any idea that any of that was there. Now, the tradition of St. Peter being there survived, but only as a loose tradition. The writings and so on were all gone except for the ones I described. So when they began excavating, what did they run into? But Roman tomb after Roman tomb, the greatest collection of Roman artwork and statuary really in the whole world. Now a fabulous tour called the Scavi Tour. And for the vividness, at least, of colors and so on, I think the greatest collection of Roman art in the world. It's ironic, but when Michelangelo is walking through the Vatican and is trying to duplicate Roman art, 12 or 15 feet below him is the greatest collection of Roman art in the whole world that exists. He has no idea it's there, neither did anybody else. So they began doing that. They go to Roman tomb after tomb, and then they decide, we're going to give up on that, and we're going to go right to the center. They're, at this point, are headed by Father Ferrua, who has effectively replaced Ludwig Koss in charge of it. Father Ferrua is a fine and dedicated man, but he's a bit of a treasure hunter as opposed to a systematic archaeologist. And so he heads right for the center because he thinks that's where Peter is going to be found based on the Book of Popes. In the center, they find one of the strangest structures that's ever been encountered in all of archaeology. They find first the altar, if I can call it that, built by Bernini in the construction of the new St. Peter's.
And now you're talking about going from the outside in, right?
They skip over everything.
Okay.
And go dead center into the center.
Okay.
Instead of working methodically in, they abandoned the Roman tombs at that time.
Okay.
And 1942, 43, they go dead to the center, right to where they think Peter's going to be found. And in the dead center, they find first a tomb or wall or enclosure built at the time that the original church was, the new St. Peter's was built.
So it was 16th century.
1500.
1500.
Roughly 1500.
Mm-hmm.
All right, they've got to break that open, which is kind of a tragedy in itself, but they break it open, It's sealed, which is very important. Inside of it is another enclosure built in the 1100s in the age of the Crusades. It's also sealed, so nobody ever went in there since 1100. And inside that, they find an enclosure built by Pope Gregory, roughly 600 AD, likewise completely sealed. And they break open the last one, and they're on the inside now. They find the Trophy of Gaius, that long-ago trophy that people said they would find there. It looks like a pagan marker, but when you look on the inside of it, it has invocations to the saints. So the Christians, circa 150, they can't erect a cross. Why, everybody would be killed by the Romans. So they erect a pagan-looking marker, and they put their prayers on the inside of it. Mm-hmm. They think they've solved the puzzle, and they find some bones close to, but not under the marker, near a wall. And they think for a while those are the bones of Peter, without declaring them as such. When those are tested much later, they're the bones of a woman, not a man, and so they're not Peter's bones. Immediately next to the marker is a wall that becomes very, very important, called the graffiti wall. Father Ferrua dismisses the graffiti wall as unreadable. He says it's just all meaningless graffiti, and he ignores the graffiti wall. In terms of the human remains that are being encountered, they simply ship these to storage and don't analyze them in any way. And they make little effort to preserve the murals. They regard the Roman murals as not particularly valuable because they're not Christian objects. Okay, so they solve the problem where the tomb is, but there are no relics of Peter there. Word leaks out. Many other things happen. The Jews are hidden in the underground and in the Vatican to preserve them from the Nazis in World War II.
All this is going on simultaneously. Yes.
All of it's happening at the same time. Mm-hmm. And the entire underground floods in 1948, it's almost all lost. The communists try to take over Italy and they fail. The strikes help out in all that a great deal. Understand that what George Strait did was discovered the third largest oil field ever discovered in the United States, and he took all the money and gave it to the Catholic causes.
Right, so we have to, part of your story is telling us about the people, the personal stories that are all
right.
involved in this extraordinary discovery. And George Strait, of course, is important, not just as a Houstonian, but as a financier, basically, of this entire project.
Well, he's an astounding character. You know, the oil industry isn't full of people like George Strait. No industry is. And George Strait's born the 10th of 10 children, an orphan. His parents die. He's raised by his two sisters. They have no money, can't go to school of any kind. He's a messenger boy for Western Union. He takes a test for St. Louis University, being self-educated. He passes it. They learn he's never been to school, and then they do an amazing thing. They let him into St. Louis University and give him a full scholarship. He takes geology and engineering. He graduates, does very well, and then goes and fights in the First World War. He's in the Army Air Corps. He's a wireless operator, which becomes important later on because he begins investing in radio. At the end of the war, he has the idea of buying someday. His dream is to buy a valley in Colorado. He marries a woman named Susan. Susan becomes really critical to him twice. George is sort of an introverted, gruff guy. I mean, what do you have when you have an oil guy who's been in the Army? It's not, you know, that's George. Well, Susan is a person that everybody loves. You never meet anyone who Susan didn't love and who didn't love Susan. And so they get married. They go to Tampico, Mexico, where he's in charge of the golf office. And Susan does the first really important thing. She starts taking care of the little babies next door. The little babies next door are Jim, Pat, and Bill Buckley, the three Buckley children, the famous Bill Buckley who started National Review, Jim Buckley, senator from New York. And the Buckleys grow to love Susan and George. And so they say, look, go in the oil business down here and we'll back you. And so he goes in the oil business. He's very successful for both himself and the Buckleys. And he makes a great move. He sells out before the Mexican government seizes everything around circa 1924, 25. He makes a bad move. He goes to Korea, to Cuba, to go in the car business. The Great Depression descends. He says to Susan, "Susan, we better get out of here before we have to swim back." And he's going to Oregon to be in the lumber business. And the fortuity of all this always strikes me in this whole story, including the Vatican story. He goes to Houston only because his mother-in-law is dying. And so he can't stay in the hospital. It's just not in him. But he's in Houston, so he wanders around southeast of Conroe, north of Houston, and he notices that the animals are not drinking any of the water and that all the creeks flow to the northeast. And so from that, he leases up 10,000 acres in an area that oil company after oil company drilled and went bankrupt in. And he goes to all the big oil companies and tries to raise money to drill. They all laugh at him. They say, "Where's your seismic? Where's your reservoir engineering?" And he says, "Well, the animals don't drink the water," and so on. And that doesn't go very far. And so he goes to Susan, and he says, "Susan, I'd like to drill this. It'll take the last money we have on Earth. We'll be out in the street if I don't hit, but I'm pretty sure there's oil there. Will you stand with me?" And Susan says, "George, I'll do it on one condition." And he says, "Well, what's the condition?" And she says, "George, I'll stand with you in this if you agree that if you hit oil, you will never question anything else I buy for the rest of my life." Well, George signs on without letting the story out. Susan becomes a famous shopper before the story is all over. And George drills. First, he hits only gas, which is kind of a booby prize in those days. But they start a filling station, take the liquids out of the gas, and they drill a second time. The second time, they hit the third largest oil field ever hit in the United States, the biggest oil field ever owned by a single individual. That oil field produced over 500 million barrels of crude oil in the Second World War alone through the Big Inch, carried through the Big Inch pipeline. He becomes inconceivably wealthy. He almost loses everything in a huge blowout by another operator in 1933. He brings great people in. They bring the oil field back under control. And so by 1930, when Walter Carroll approaches him, he's one of the wealthiest men in the world, but he has a strange little picadillo, and that picadillo is on his desk. He has a saying that says, "God doesn't care what you do with your money when you die. He only cares what you do with it while you're alive."
It's 1940, right?
This is 1940.
Yeah, okay.
At any rate, and so he gives it all, he's giving everything he has away to the Catholic Church and causes of the Catholic Church, which is why they come and approach him. He has a second condition, and only one. His condition is that if he gives you the money for a project, you will never tell anybody that he gave it to you. And you won't name it after him. You're not going to be Rockefeller Center. You're not going to be all the places in the Metropolitan Museum. There's not going to be a strike, anything. He's just going to give you the money.
Except for the high school.
And anonymously. Every donation is anonymous.
We have this strike high school, strike Jesuit high school.
All after he died.
Oh, really? Okay.
It was Houston Jesuit during his life.
Okay, I didn't know that.
He died in 1969. The high school had to be refunded because they lost all their money, and so the strikes, after his death, refunded it.
Okay.
They named it Strike Jesuit. The same way with the Strike Scout Camp north of here.
Okay.
Never until his death. After his death, it wouldn't permit anything to be named after him. St. Joseph's Hospital he started and endowed wouldn't permit it to be named after him. St. Anne's, you won't find his name anywhere on St. Anne's. It was designed around his kitchen table, actually, and a million other things. There is only one statue of George Strait in the whole world, or two of them. One is in Conroe, picture of him as an oil guy. Second, in a faraway place called Garbatelli in a bad part of Rome, there's his likeness. And they put it up. He didn't agree to it. They just put it up there. A newspaper account said he saved Italy from the communists. And he has a look, I've always thought, as I mentioned to you, the look on his face is, "What am I doing here in Garbatelli in Rome?" Anyway, they stuck it up. So he was the perfect donor to come to. He was used to a project with tremendous risk. He was incredibly a devout Christian. He read the Bible every single day, deeply Catholic, a deep devotion to the church, and he believed that all of his wealth had been given to him by God to give back. He said, all those oil companies thought I was a crazy wildcatter. He said, what they didn't know is I was a crazy wildcatter with God on my shoulder. And so that's how he happened to be picked for this particular thing. And he funded this project and many others continuously throughout his life with hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars.
Hey everybody, Eric here for Catholic Reads, and I just wanted to say thank you for listening to the first half of this interview with Courtney Guest Kim and John O'Neill. It was a really long interview, so we had to break it up into two separate sections so we could upload it properly. But don't worry, the second half of the interview with Courtney and John will be up very shortly. So until that time, stay tuned to Catholic Reads.